You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
Welcome to the Director Series Podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile. In this context, 2009's Inglourious Basterds and 2012's Django Unchained are bound together, a sub-movement within a larger one, united by a righteous bloodlust to avenge the Holocaust and slavery, two of the gravest injustices in recent history. Both reappropriate the grammar and iconography of the spaghetti western genre, only the villain isn't some black hat cowboy with a twirling mustache. No, Tarantino's antagonist is nothing less than the suffocating, dehumanizing shadow of fascism, embodied in the obvious guise of Adolf Hitler and his Nazi regime, as well as the abominable machinations of the slave trade. Though justice is on his characters' minds, their actions on behalf of oppressed and dehumanized populaces is less about revenge than it is about reclamation of humanity. With newer and more decentralized forms of xenophobia, isolationism, and yes, fascism on the rise both at home and abroad, both films take on a renewed significance and urgency. They are Tarantino's way of urging us to reassert our humanity, imperfections, warts, and all, if good is to ultimately triumph over the most insidious forces the world has ever known. It could be argued that one of the major components of Tarantino's success is a long gestational period, whereby his ideas marinate for years before coalescing into a coherent and compelling story. When he quickly dashed off a script, like he had done with 2007's Death Proof, the result was not exactly up to par. Mired in the disappointment of that film's commercial failure, and his sustained phase of collaborations with fellow director and friend Robert Rodriguez having come to an apparent close, Tarantino must have felt compelled to shake off the stink by quickly mounting another production. For years, he had been quietly developing an ambitious film he called Inglourious Basterds, a men-on-a-mission film set in France during World War II, similar in style to Robert Aldrich's 1967 classic The Dirty Dozen, or Enzo Castellari's 1978 film, also titled Inglourious Basterds. The project had taken on something of a mythical quality as one of his great unmade works, teased to his audience over the preceding years in tantalizing snippets. For instance, frequent collaborator Michael Madsen was at one point set to star as a character named Babe Paczynski, and Adam Sandler reportedly was the choice to fill the role of Sergeant Donnie Donowitz, the so-called Bear Jew. Like his Kill Bill saga before it, the screenplay to Inglourious Basterds inevitably got away from him, sprawling outward in scope until the small band of Nazi scalpers at story's center had become mere supporting characters in a larger ensemble piece about a secret, intricately coordinated plot to topple the Nazi regime in one swift, decisive stroke. Tarantino himself had come to see the project as a potential magnum opus, and after the disappointment of Death Proof, he decided the time was right to double down on himself and finally produce Inglourious Basterds, and in the process, recapture some much-needed glory for himself.
Each and every man under my command owes me 100 Nazi scalps. And all y'all will get me 100 Nazi scalps, taken from the heads of 100 dead Nazis. Or you will die trying.
The final iteration of Tarantino's long gestating story follows two separate threads that eventually combine into a spectacular climax of death and destruction. The first thread concerns the eponymous bastards, headed by a tough SOB named Lieutenant Aldo Rain, who has charged each of his men with a procurement of 100 Nazi scalps. Meanwhile, a young Jewish girl named Shoshana hides in plain sight under an assumed name and occupation as a French theater owner after escaping the massacre of her family at the hands of the fearsome Jew hunter, Colonel Hans Landa. When events conspire to host the premiere of a prestigious Nazi propaganda film at her theater, in which Hitler himself is slated to attend, she hatches a plot to burn the theater down with everyone trapped inside. The bastards learn of this premiere separately, hatching their own plot when they learn of the details from their informant, the illustrious German film star Brigitte von Hammersmark. For a film set during the height of World War II, Inglourious Basterds is curiously short on action, choosing instead to structure itself as a handful of dialogue-driven, self-contained episodes. To say that the performances would need to be appropriately compelling is quite the understatement. but this is an arena where Tarantino has already proven his superlative talents, and several times over. Even though he receives top billing, Brad Pitt is only one cog in the complex machinery of characterization that Tarantino orchestrates. The famous movie star makes a compelling case that he's actually a world-class character actor trapped in the body of a leading man, turning in his most outlandish persona yet as the Tennessee-born and bred Lieutenant Aldo Raine. Better known by his enemies as the Apache, Lieutenant Raine is a vengeful force of nature, a tough yet sophisticated commando with a mysterious neck scar that's never explained, but nevertheless alludes to the magnitude of his resilience and grit. In short, he's a perfect avatar to convey Tarantino's cartoonish take on history. Though Madsen or Sandler ultimately did not make the final roster of supporting players, Tarantino's assembled cast more than satisfies his audience's expectations. After his brief appearance in Death Proof, Tarantino protege and fellow director Eli Roth graduates to the key role of the Bear Jew, Sergeant Donnie Donowitz. Donning a trashy wife beater and a heavy masshole accent, Donowitz gets his intimidating nickname on account of his bearish impatience and an inclination to savagely bash Nazi brains using a baseball bat, scrawled with the names of Jewish friends and family members back home. To be sure, Roth is not an actor by trade, preferring to remain behind the camera. However, his performance in Inglourious Basterds displays an unexpected degree of talent that serves the film's purposes rather well. Tarantino finds a use for Roth's more natural talents by enlisting him to direct Nation's Pride, the propaganda film within a film, whose premiere the Nazis are celebrating. Also following Roth from Death Proof is Omar Doom, playing Private Omar Ulmer. B.J. Novak, better known for his role in the popular NBC sitcom The Office, plays another fellow bastard, Private Smithson. There's also Till Schweiger as the stoic Nazi hunter Sergeant Hugo Stiglitz. In addition to getting his own grindhouse-esque backstory sequence, Schweiger gets some of the film's best lines, like,
"See how feeders into your Nazi boss."
Irish actor Michael Fassbender finds his mainstream breakout in the role of British serviceman Lieutenant Archie Hickox. Fassbender effortlessly assumes the droll, aristocratic nature of his character, a film critic in the civilian sector, further imbued with the subtle confidence that somehow makes him even more badass than his American colleagues. Celebrated comedian Mike Myers makes an almost unrecognizable cameo appearance as Hickox's commanding officer, General Fanny, serving up a positively chameleon-esque performance that makes great use of his talents to subtle, engaging effect. Though Inglourious Basterds mostly does away with the key players of the Tarantino repertory, past performers like Harvey Keitel and Samuel L. Jackson manage to make voice cameos.
"Colonel Landa will put you and Private Yudovich in a truck as prisoners."
Keitel as an OSS commander, and Jackson as an omniscient narrator explaining nitrate film's flammability, an integral component of the film's climactic conspiracy.
35mm nitrate film was so flammable that you couldn't even bring a reel onto a streetcar.
Inglourious Basterds also features some fierce female performances in the form of Diane Kruger and Melanie Laurent. Kruger uses her natural glamour to striking degree as the elegant German actress Diane von Hammersmark. In such a testosterone-laden film, she's a breath of fresh air. But make no mistake, she's just as tough as any bastard, if not more so. She plays a crucial role as the bastard's inside woman, and her participation helps pave the way for Hitler's downfall and the end of World War II, at least in Tarantino's alternate timeline. Equally as determined is Laurent as the hardened survivor Shoshana. Having witnessed her entire family massacred by the Nazis, she channels her trauma and grief into a fearlessness that's strong enough to bring down the entire Nazi regime. Less fierce is Julie Dreyfus, who serves in a similar capacity to her Sophie Fatale role in Kill Bill Volume 1. Here, she plays Francesca Mondino, the French interpreter and sexual plaything to Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. It's really more of a small cameo, but her reprisal of the glamorous assistant-slash-interpreter-slash-confidant archetype further points to the running themes and in-jokes across Tarantino's entire body of work. And then there's Inglourious Basterds' big revelation. The man that anybody who saw the film could not stop raving about. The man whose performance was so striking that it launched him from European obscurity to American Oscar winner overnight. Yes, we're talking about Christoph Waltz, the seasoned character actor who until recently was essentially unknown to our shores. As the chief antagonist Colonel Hans Landa, Waltz is positively electrifying. He's at once both charming and cold-blooded, concealing a very deadly ferocity with a giggling, gentlemanly demeanor. He goes against every single villain expectation in the book, even going so far as to defect to the Allied side when he realizes the Nazis can't win, proving that the most dangerous man in the room is the one beholden to no particular belief or ideology. Waltz is endlessly entertaining in the role, running away with the film so thoroughly that it's now inconceivable that Tarantino had initially pursued Leonardo DiCaprio for the part. Behind the camera, Tarantino once again utilizes the talents of his Kill Bill cinematographer Robert Richardson to render the somber, rustic locales in vivid, bright color. They style the film as a modern-day spaghetti western, albeit set in war-torn Europe, even going so far as to title one chapter Once Upon a Time in Nazi-Occupied France. The 2:39:1 aspect ratio allows for dramatic, expansive compositions, and the low-key lighting scheme allows for a deep contrast that gives the film palpable weight. Inglourious Basterds boasts an autumnal palette, with desaturated greens and wet, drab stone grays that allow for the bright reds of blood and Nazi flags to really pop. Camera-wise, Inglourious Basterds is Tarantino's most restrained work yet. He chooses to keep the camera locked off for a vast majority of the film, strategically employing dollies and cranes only when they serve a strong story purpose. This being Tarantino's first period piece, returning production designer David Wasko has the unenviable challenge of faithfully recreating the era through the various sets that the cast inhabits. Of these, Shoshana's theater arguably stands out as the most dynamic, having been reportedly modeled after the iconic Vista Theater in Los Angeles. Having recently been exposed by Rodriguez to the joys of an original score, Tarantino's spaghetti western ambitions aspire to no less than famed Italian composer Ennio Morricone as the ideal composer for Inglourious Basterds. When that didn't happen, he did the next best thing, and reappropriated some of the maestro's pre-existing cues alongside some tracks he had previously used in Kill Bill. Indeed, one would be hard-pressed to find another director as prominent as Tarantino, using pre-existing score from other films as needle drops within his own, in the same way that one might use pop music or rock and roll. To Tarantino, however, film music is rock and roll. There's no difference. What it was initially created for, or when it was created, bears no difference to his story. It need only strike to the core of whatever vibe he's trying to convey at a particular moment. This is best exemplified in the use of an anachronistic David Bowie track during a moody prelude to the film's climax. In perpetuating this practice, Tarantino unshackles music from the context of its time, allowing for unprecedented levels of thematic expression. Though he's often held up as a paragon of auteur theory, Tarantino has always touted the contributions of his valued collaborators. The aforementioned Richardson and Wasko have played integral roles in bringing Tarantino's vision to the screen, as have regular producing partners like Lawrence Bender and, more unfortunately for all of humanity, Harvey Weinstein. Out of all the people who could lay claim to helping Tarantino become the director he is today, Sally Menke's contributions arguably put her head and shoulders above anyone else. She is the ultimate shaper of Tarantino's vision, finding the music in his dynamic compositions and harnessing the raw energy of his direction into a visceral viewing experience. The flawlessly edited Inglourious Basterds marks the high point, the culmination of their partnership. Unfortunately, it also marks the last time they will ever work together. Menke unexpectedly passed away in 2010, as she was hiking in Los Angeles' Griffith Park, and with her death, Tarantino lost his co-author and his creative partner. Inglourious Basterds is an unconventional war film in that it doesn't concern itself with battle, but rather with the thematic conceit of language. Right down to the intentionally misspelled title, Tarantino makes no bones about language as the driving force of the film. The majority of Inglourious Basterds is in languages other than English, with several characters switching tongues as easily as you would slip out of a t-shirt and into a new one. Christoph Waltz flits from German to Italian to English and French without so much as a second thought, making his Hans Landa character a truly formidable foe in a world where language itself is a weapon. Tarantino also plays the linguistic divide for laughs, such as a truly hysterical moment where Brad Pitt's syrupy southern drawl butchers the elegant musicality of the Italian language.
Buongiorno.
And who can forget this absolutely ridiculous line?
Ooh, that's a bingo.
You just say bingo.
Indeed, the film itself is structured like that perennial celebration of language, the novel. Tarantino's use of self-contained sequences designated as chapters, instead of conventional three-act structure, has never been more justified. And just like a novel, Tarantino isn't afraid to dwell on the minutiae of a single moment. The longest scenes in the film, the opening in the French farmhouse or the basement tavern rendezvous with Hammersmark, go on for almost half an hour each, dragging out the suspense to an almost unbearable degree until it is released in an explosion of blood and violence. Structural Mexican standoffs turn quite literal.
That's a Mexican standoff, and that was not the deal.
Other stylistic trademarks are all present and accounted for. The yellow title font, the creative profanity, upward-looking victim cam compositions, elaborate tracking shots, etc., etc. Something about these signatures has changed, however. Whether it's reflective of his gradual maturity, or he's feeding off a continental kind of sophistication, his style suddenly feels refined and worldly, where it once could be called undisciplined, coarse, or even vulgar. It's fitting that Tarantino's story uses a movie theater as an important element, to the extent that it plays a hand in ending World War II. The multitude of film references in his previous work have all built up to this, wherein a movie premiere becomes a watershed moment in world history and turns a generation of Americans into film buffs, albeit only within Tarantino's self-contained universe. He uses Shoshana's theater as the climax's venue, showing it off in an elaborately elegant tracking shot, similar to how he presented the geography of Kill Bill Volume 1's House of Blue Leaves set. Whereas the latter sequence tends to come off as showboaty, here Tarantino exercises a degree of restraint that builds tension and anticipation by expertly setting up the dominoes for an explosive finale. If Inglourious Basterds could be thought of as a vehicle for Tarantino's comeback campaign, then mission accomplished. In addition to a Palme d'Or-nominated bow at Cannes, the film would command the best box office grosses and critical reviews of his career to date, culminating in an Oscar win for Waltz's performance and nominations for Best Picture, Director, Original Screenplay, Cinematography, Editing, Sound Editing, and Sound Mixing. Just as expectedly, it also drew a significant amount of controversy. Some were uncertain whether the concept of Jews aggressively pursuing revenge on the Nazis was in poor taste or not, or if it was maybe too insensitive to survivors of the Holocaust. Still, others were frustrated by Tarantino's blatant historical revisionism, which takes the apocryphal tack of gunning down Hitler in a gleeful hail of bullets during the theater inferno sequence, as opposed to him offing himself in a bunker as he did in real life. The bottom line, however, is that this is Tarantino's story to tell as he sees fit. One man's act of historical wish fulfillment that nevertheless stays within the outlandish tone of the narrative that precedes it. By baking in such cartoonishness into the very center of his stylistic aesthetic, Tarantino grants himself the license to alter the past as he sees fit, making for a cathartic ending to World War II that's fit enough for the movies, if not the history books. It seems safe to say that Inglourious Basterds marks the beginning of a new, more prestigious career phase for Tarantino. Now firmly ensconced in middle age, he's closer to his elder statesman of cinema years than his 90s boy wonder heyday, and the question of his legacy is more pressing than ever. This doesn't mean that he's lost his youthful predilections towards grandeur, however. After all, Inglourious Basterds closes with a sentiment that says much more about his artistic intent than it does any textual sentiment offered up by the story.
I think this just might be my masterpiece.
It's likely no coincidence that it was around this time Tarantino announced his intent to cap his ultimate feature output at a neat, even 10. He'd rather retire at the top of his game instead of fritter away his golden years with increasingly irrelevant work. Whether or not he ultimately holds true to this self-imposed edict remains to be seen. But if so, then the making of Inglourious Basterds places him well into the back half of his anticipated total output. By infusing his filmmaking with real, personal stakes, Tarantino's voice is invigorated almost out of sheer necessity. If it can be said that there's little room for error when one is firmly in the endgame, then Inglourious Basterds sees the celebrated filmmaker off to an auspicious start.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free.